So we'll get the session started. So our next paper is Clinics and Clinic Clusters in Enschleit Morphographies. And it'll be John Elliott, who's speaking to us today.
Is this working? Anyone hear me all right? Okay. I don't know if I need the mic in the first place, but so my name is John Elliott. I'm a PhD student here at UH. And the research for my dissertation focuses on the documentation and description of a language called Enschleit Sur, which is one of the languages in this Enschleit family. And my talk today is about how speakers and writers of different languages in this family have addressed this problem of clitics and clitic clusters and how to write them in their languages, right? So the goal here is to apply more recent morphological and phonological descriptions of clitics and how they work in the E languages. They generally work the same in all of them, to a comparison of different representations of clitics in different E orthographies. So basically I'm looking at how closely related languages have done different things with very similar linguistic material, right? So here's kind of what I'm going to do. I'm going to start with just a little bit of background on the languages and also like who reads and writes in these languages. I'm going to say a little bit about what a clitic is, specifically what clitics look like in Enschleit languages and some of the grammatical features that are important to know about when we look at their kind of orthographic representations. And then the meat here is going to be looking at some of these different orthographic strategies that speakers and writers have used to represent clitics and cliticization. And then I'll kind of summarize at the end. But the main here is just kind of a exploratory description and comparison between different styles and different approaches. So Enschleit and Enschleit, which I'm going to write as just EE most of the time. I might say EE. If I say Enschleit languages, I mean this. It's kind of hard for me to say even still, at least quickly. It's a small language family, also known as Mascoyan, that's spoken in the Paraguayan Chaco. So this is Paraguay in South America. Paraguay is kind of cut down the middle by the Paraguay River, and the western half is in the Chaco, which is a larger ecoregion that kind of extends into Bolivia and Argentina. This red area here is kind of the contiguous traditional territory of Enschleit and Enschleit speakers. The area itself is very flat. It's usually very hot. It kind of goes through extremes of extreme drought versus extreme flooding. So it's pretty sparsely populated. People kind of don't live closely together. But across the language family, there's about somewhere between maybe 13 to 15,000 total speakers of all of the languages, all six in the family, although it's not spread evenly across those six languages. So you have Enschleit Norte, Enschleit Sur, which is the one that I do research on in particular, Angaite, Sanapana, Guana, and Toba Enschleit, or just Enschleit. And the vitality of these languages ranges, it kind of runs the gamut. So you have Guana, which is a highly endangered language. There's only four known speakers left of this language, whereas Enschleit Norte has upwards of 7,000 speakers and maybe is even growing in speaker number, at least in some of its communities. Most of the other languages are kind of somewhere in the middle. Angaite and Sanapana have a few hundred speakers each, but most kids in those communities don't speak the language. Whereas Enschleit Sur and Enschleit, there's some places where people don't use the language, but in most communities, it's still pretty vibrant. A majority of people use the languages still. So if we're talking about orthography, it's important to know like who's actually using writing for these languages. Who are Enschleit readers and writers? Onur and Kalish, writing mostly about Enschleit Norte, but also about EE speakers in general, said about 20 years ago that most EE speakers are only kind of semi-literate in their language, in that they can read, they can kind of like read the written word, but very few have like strong confidence in their ability to write and produce written material. So very few people actually can or choose to write in their languages, even if they have kind of an ability to read it when it's written down in front of them. The production of written material as a result has historically been kind of limited, both in the domains in which it's produced and the people who are producing it. There's not a lot of people who are producing written documents in the languages. The most ubiquitous is church writing, right? So the first people to write down any of these languages were actually not speakers, but they were missionaries, both English-speaking and German-speaking, who were writing down the languages primarily for missionary purposes. And although, speakers have kind of since taken over the reins of producing that kind of material, still probably the most, for a lot of speakers, the largest textual interaction they have with their language is through like Bibles and church hymnals and that kind of material. It's pretty ubiquitous. Kind of close behind that is like school material. Use of the indigenous languages in community schools is, it fluctuates quite a lot. It usually doesn't extend past about the third grade, but there are materials that are made for use in the schools. A lot of that is just individual teachers who are committed and they make their own materials, handwrite a lot of stuff. I actually have a couple examples from that type of material later on. But there's also kind of projects to make kind of small textbooks in the languages, especially by the National Ministry of Education. This is like one Sanapana kids book. These are usually, you know, 30, 40 pages. They get a collection of speakers to contribute descriptions of like plants and animals, right? So these are pretty widespread across different communities. And then finally, you know, other types of kind of one-off publications happen here and there. So like stories or transcriptions of oral histories or traditional stories might be produced, although usually these are like initiated by outside groups, so like government projects or missionary groups or NGOs will like sponsor the production of like a volume of texts. And there's also a group that I'll mention later that's actually run out of an Entlet Norte community that also produces a lot of texts in mostly Entlet Norte, but a few other languages. Most of those are like oral histories. But that kind of historical context, what's been true up till now about most people not doing a lot of writing is probably something that's going to be changing a lot in the near future. I've been going to Paraguay and working in these communities and Entlet Sur communities since 2015. And just in that time, there's been a huge explosion of social media use, right? So a lot of people now in just the last few years, they have phones. There's increasing 4G access in a lot of the communities. And there's very cheap WhatsApp, Facebook bundle plans. It's usually like when you get a phone, that's part of the bundle is WhatsApp and Facebook. And so there's this kind of new domain for writing that if these languages, or at least some of them, are kind of successfully migrated into the new domain, you might have a situation where a lot more people are regular writers of these languages than have been previously, right? So this is like a Facebook conversation between a couple of Entlet Sur speakers, and it's trilingual, right? So there's Spanish, there's Entlet here, and Guarani down at the bottom, right? So if kind of people continue to use their Entlet and this domain, and there's going to be a lot more written Entlet in the future, and some of these questions about how you write certain things may become more more on the top of people's minds in the future than maybe it is right now. So we're talking here about clitics and how clitics are represented in the language. So we need to maybe talk a little bit about what that means. I do not want to get into a technical discussion of what clitics mean with a room full of linguists. Lots of people have different definitions. There's a lot of theoretical baggage that goes in with it. But in general, a clitic, for practical purposes, is some piece of a language that is somewhere between, right? It's not quite a bound affix. It's not really part of a word proper, but it's also not really its own independent word, right? So like in English, we have examples like I'd have known or he'll go, where this ul or the udv, right? These are like part of the larger word, their phonologic part of the word, but they're not really, you know, if English speakers think of I'd have as an individual word, I don't know, it's questionable, right? But these pieces also can't kind of stand alone, right? Clitics usually don't carry their own stress. They're phonologically dependent on the thing that they attach to, right, which is usually called their host. It's the term that I'll use. They usually don't occur as like independent words. And by and large, they tend to have more like grammatical type functions, right? So they do tense and aspect, or they are pronominal markers. And especially relevant for like, you know, orthography development and design is the way that people think about pieces that are maybe clitics in a language. So, you know, if you ask speakers whether they recognize a clitic as an independent word, they'll say, no, that's not really a word, but it also might not be something that people think of as part of a word proper, right? So a good example, in every EE language, there's a past tense marker, hasta. It's extremely commonly used, right? It's a past tense marker. People say it, you know, probably hundreds of times a day, right? But if you ask a speaker, as I have plenty of times, what does hasta mean, right? For most people, if they're not highly literate, if they don't write a lot themselves, probably what they'll say is, hasta, which means night, right? It's like an independent word that kind of sounds like that. So people's, you know, metalinguistic awareness of clitics is also kind of complicated, right? It's not so clear cut. And that's one of the reasons that these orthographic decisions about where you, you know, do you put them on with the word or do you separate them are kind of complicated, is because people don't, you know, have a really strong grasp on what they are, right? Here's an example from Sanapana. Most of the clitics in EE languages are like enclitics, or at the very least, they come after the thing they cliticize to, right? So they're not proclitics, they're enclitics. So you have like here the verb asitniishkit, which is the kind of verb proper, I sleep, right? Any speaker would think of this as a single definite word, right? You cannot break that up for sure, right? That's everyone's intuition. But this extra piece here, that's something like a same-day past marker, is a little more complex, right? Phonologically, it's part of the word. It has some like changes and reductions that only happen when it comes after a vowel, right? But this is what clitics look like in this language. There's two major types. There's one kind of group of clitics that do things like tense and aspect and evidentiality, and there's kind of a separate set of demonstrative clitics, so this versus that thing I was talking about, right? And those are kind of patterned together, but there's some other things like a conjunction clitic and some of the independent-ish pronouns phonologically kind of glom onto the word before them. But in general, especially these top two categories, these are extremely, you know, common, important, basic, fundamental parts of the grammar, right? So how you treat them orthographically is not like a fringe issue, right? It's something that is in, you know, a majority of utterances. A couple other grammatical points real quickly. Most of the clitics have some kind of change of form depending on their context, right? The most common one is whether or not they attach to a vowel final versus a consonant final host, right? So like here you have this base word with two clitics, yentapashnakshle from Toba in Inflet. And here you have this snak, which is like a reportative marker, which means, you know, I heard this from somebody else, it's not firsthand knowledge. And after this vowel, the form is snak, right? Whereas if it comes after a consonant, the form is just nak, right? So you have these kinds of alternations. And the other important point is that you can have a lot of these actually on one host. It's pretty normal. Normally, you know, you have like maybe one or two, maybe one tame clitic, one kind of demonstrative clitic. But it's possible, especially with the tame clitics, to have four, five, even six in some cases glommed onto the same host, right? And when you have more than one clitic, there is kind of template is a sticky word for some people, but there's kind of a basic ordering that these things that governs the order of these pieces, right? So if you have more than one, there's a necessary order that they have to come in. So you can't like move them around to like create differences in meaning or anything like that. So how do we go about like representing these things that are sort of part of words, maybe not really part of words? The basic question is, how do we represent this type of boundary, right? There's basically three options, right? There's really only three options. You either make a word break, right? You have a blank space. You don't, and you write everything as one single orthographic word, or you use some kind of special symbol to mark the boundary, right? This is what we do, like, in English, idiv, right? We have apostrophes. And this is what we do, you know, as linguists, too. We have this equals symbol that marks a particular type of clitic boundary, as distinct from other types of boundaries. And when we talk about whether or not to split words up or put them together, there's kind of two competing pressures that we need to keep in mind. And I'm kind of summarizing a summary of this research from KL 2018, where he says, on the one hand, you know, long words are hard for readers to parse. They're hard to pick apart and understand, especially if you're a learner, right, if you're not fully literate. So if you take that example of, you know, a long verb already that has a lot of parts, and then you take all the clitics and you wrote as one long orthographic word, you have a real kind of nightmare of a word, right? This would be hard for anybody to read, let alone somebody who's not fully literate in the language, right? Be it if it's a child trying to learn to read, or even an adult trying to learn to read, right? This is a hard thing to process. But at the same time, splitting up things that go together can also make comprehension difficult, right? Especially if when you break things up, you end up writing orthographic words that speakers don't recognize as a meaningful unit or that they can't pronounce, right? So like in that example I showed you a second ago from Toba, from Enenflet, this snak is usually written as an independent orthographic word, but this is not pronounceable, right? Enenflet languages actually can't have consonant clusters at the beginning. So if you have a kid learning to read and they say, what's this word? And you say snak, one, it might be kind of hard to say that. And second of all, this kid probably knows that's not a word, right? You can't just ever say that. It doesn't fit the language. So what I'm going to do in most of the rest of the presentation is talk about a few different strategies that different writers and different writing traditions have used to address some of these issues. One is the degree to which people just write the clitic as just part of the host, right? By and large, for the languages that have pretty robust standard orthographies, especially Inlet Sur and Inlet Norte, writers generally keep the clitics separate, right? They don't write them as part of the orthographic word with their host. But even still, in all these systems, there's some clitics that are always written with their hosts, right? So like in Inlet Sur, the dubitative clitic that shows doubt is pretty much always written as part of its host, right? In Sanapana, the kind of visual evidential marker is pretty much always written as part of an orthographic word with what it goes with, right? But even when there's like existing standardizations, when there's like conventions about how to do this, speakers will still have conflicting intuitions and go against them, right? So a school teacher might write something, has written something in one of my texts. This ekthemanakso, it's like this right here, which in the standard orthography would normally be written as three separate words, and the writer writes it as one single word, right? But usually, in any instance where I've found that writers kind of buck the standardization and they write the clitics with the word, there's usually some kind of inconsistency, right? So here's, you have this sa, which is a future marker, you know, on the same page here being written as part of the orthographic word with its host, here with a space, right? And I even asked the person, the writer who made this, why this was one word and why this was two, and you know, the answer is, it just feels right, right? So when I say there's inconsistency, what I really mean is, you know, maybe there's a reason, but I don't really know what it would be, right? People have intuitions, but. So another approach that's been used in a few cases is the use of an explicit cliticization symbol. So this NNE, Ningwanam Kiskuma, and then Paiwa Manflet is a group based out of an Inta Norte community that produces texts that kind of look like this. They're short stories, oral histories. And they use a symbol that's this kind of like floating dot here to represent some kind of phonological dependency of one word to the one that comes before it. So it's used for clitics, like here the conjunction clitic nhan is marked in front with this little dot because of the fact that it can't stand on its own, right? It's not pronounceable as its own word. But the problem with this one is that its use is not limited to clitics. It's actually just a strict phonological rule. And it's used anytime that a phonetic or an orthographic form of a word would be unpronounceable. And the thing is, inflet words across the word boundary, if you have a vowel final before a vowel initial, you always are going to get rid of one of them, right? So you end up with a situation where you have a serious like conflation of clitic boundaries and word boundaries and orthographic units that do not match with morphological or prosodic ones, right? So you apply this kind of, this thing needs to go here because it can't stand on its own. This needs to be attached because it can't go on its own, but it doesn't line up with the break that's actually right here in the middle, kind of morphologically. A different approach to basically the same problem that this little marker is trying to address is what I call a dummy vowel, which is where, this is used in Inlet Sur orthographies, where writers just write an initial vowel, whether it's pronounced or not, in order to not have unpronounceable independent words. So for example, this is the Inlet Sur same date past marker that after a vowel is in this form, ischik, and it's always in this form, it's always ischik, this particular form would only occur after a vowel. So this vowel that's written here would never be pronounced, right? But it's put in orthographically to make it so that you can separate this piece, have it as an independent word, while still having a form that is like pronounceable in isolation. It doesn't cause people problems and they're trying to just identify it, you know, for learners. So final strategy, I think is really actually kind of cool, probably the most interesting one here, to me anyway, is how people deal with some of these larger clusters, right? And that's writing them as units distinct from their hosts, right? So this happens sometimes when a clitic cluster, you have like two clitics that kind of always co-occur, right? So in Inlet Sur, you have a reported marker and the remote past marker. Remote past is before your lifetime, so it's pretty much always secondhand information, right? They always go together. And so orthographically, even though morphologically you can break them up, orthographically they're always one, right? They're always one piece. So you write two clitics as one chunk separate from their host. But this happens with lots of other things too. Generally with kind of clusters, strings of clitics whose forms are affected because of phonological processes that go across the clitic boundary. So like here you have three individual clitics, intlikila, which is intlaho, eki, la, that are written as one single orthographic word distinct from their host, right? Yeah, almost. So there's a handful of examples like this, different compounds where if the pieces kind of affect each other and change their forms, you write it as one single word. So in summary, just to review a couple of these things, one is the issue of how you address the phonological dependence of one piece to the next, right? And the thing is that that's an issue not just with clitics, but in some cases also things that aren't clitics, right? So both those dummy vowels I showed you and the cliticization symbol they attempt to avoid isolated, unpronounceable orthographic forms, orthographic words. They do kind of different things, right? And they have different results. Primarily, the cliticization symbol is only sensitive to phonological and not morphological conditions, and so it ends up creating orthographic words that don't actually correspond to any other kind of unit, phonological or grammatical, right? And that's probably a problem. Second, when we talk about writing clitic clusters as their own unique orthographic words separate from their host, we end up with something that's kind of a good middle ground between these two pressures that I talked about earlier, right? On one hand, it helps us avoid really long words by splitting the clitics off from their hosts, right? You have these long clitic cluster strings, and you don't write them as part of the host, so you avoid a super long word. But it is some kind of maintenance in the orthography of a cohesion of elements which are basically dependent, right? So I'm over time, but thank you guys. Take any questions, try to answer.
Questions. I'm not sure if you want to field them yourself or I can.
Either one. I don't think there's so many people that need to be managed. So.
Go ahead.
I'm wondering if you can say anything else about internal versus external sandhi in this language that would help you with that kind of wordiness problem. Because if they are actually the same, they may be the same, or there may be diagnostics you could use to tell that would be a better problem.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to imagine what exactly you mean by external versus internal sandhi in
like
this case.
Between words established, like lexeme type things versus
clicks. Oh, yeah. I mean, okay. So, yeah, I don't really know, though. One issue that's kind of been raised in some of the recent literature about like wordhood is that you might not actually be able to just draw a strict line between the word and the larger boundary anyway, right? So, what you might have is like, that's a rule that extends everywhere, right? Or has like a larger domain than the individual word. And that maybe just needs to be processed for individual languages, what like the boundaries exactly that are. But I do know that they don't extend past word boundaries, that kind of like adding and subtracting of vowels. But I don't know, I'd have to like look at a particular example. Is there one
right,
here?
Well, that's not diagnostic, obviously. When
yeah.
You're not, you're gaining or losing vowels when something, because it's across word boundaries.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, but there's a difference between the losing of the vowels that's like on the edge and then the loss of vowels that are like not on the edge. So those are like two different things. So one is just, you can wonder whether or not you're losing the vowel or gaining the vowel, but there's a difference between like that when you have vowel across a word boundary, that's one thing, and then there's the like loss or addition of a vowel between two consonants, whether there's a vowel in front of it. And those are just kind of like two different processes. So they're not like, yeah, they're not conflated things, but yeah. Yeah.
Hi. Just a real picky question, maybe. One slide you had where this person wrote this clitic one time attached and one time
not. Yeah.
And he says it just felt like that should be.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if that would relate to the total length of the word there.
Yeah.
Okay, I just looked at that and I think I thought I remembered it.
It's kind of the opposite. Yeah, because I thought about that too. And
yeah,
I think maybe if you like, if I could get my hands on enough of this kind of text, right? It's things that like one person made. They're not made by a group of people, and can kind of get some kind of quantitative value, right? You could maybe say there's some there might be some correlation between, you know, like if the word is long enough, then you have more pressure to split it off, and if it's short enough, then you put the things together. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Now that I look at it, I think it's just the reverse of what I remembered.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, this is one like isolated example.
Sure.
And yeah, I mean the verb morphology proper can get pretty long. So you do like kind of run into issues where you might have verbs that are so long that there might be like a, you know, pressure for people to split off the clitic. Yeah, that's possible. But that's just kind of a guess unless I have like actual kind of, you know, larger numerical data about what people do with it.
Another question, I mean you've seen your basic documentation is people do an awful lot of different things with these.
Yeah.
You said you really like when you have the clitic clusters, just putting them as, you know, what about not? Do you have an opinion on what a better way of doing these things might be? I mean, I'm not sure it has any impact on anything of local people, how they actually.
Yeah, no, that's the main thing. At the moment, I'm kind of just comparing and trying to see what different people do. And you know, as, like I said, a lot of it, I think, comes down to the fact that if there's going to be more writers in the future, they're going to be texting, right? And so that would be a big driver of what types of choices and recommendations you might make,
yeah,
right? And also what kinds of options you might try and make available technologically. If you're going to make a keyboard, if you're going to make a predictive text app, right? You might have something that favors splitting them off just because that's easier for like a predictive text to be able to say what's coming next, right? Whereas if you put it on one big word, then you don't have that availability to say, oh, do you mean this, do you mean this, do you mean this, because you have something that's like 30 characters long, right? So, yeah. Yeah.
Is it possible that the S, the clitic that begins with S, was written separately to avoid putting two S's in a row?
Yeah, I thought about that too. I mean, I've overanalyzed these two examples to the extent possible, but I mean, until there's like a lot more examples I can look at, I don't really know. But yeah, I thought that's a possibility, because there are, in this particular language, you have kind of S-S clusters, right? I mean, across the syllable boundary, and people tend to write that as a single S, even though it's morphologically and phonologically two separate S's. So like here, yeah, maybe it's broken up because this, you know, writer wants to make it very clear that it's two separate S's, right? That could be something to do with it, yeah. But again, anything about like how the phonological environment affects these kinds of things in people's, you know, one-off written documents, I think would need more data. Yeah. Yeah.
Two things. So in some other languages in the Chaco, I think a lot of the writing was originally done by, you know, outsiders, missionaries, and they didn't recognize clicks, didn't know anything about them, and they didn't show up in the writing.
Yeah.
And then today there's still linguists that don't really realize that these are clicks.
Yeah.
There are a couple that realize they're clicks, but they say, oh, we're not going to do anything about it, so they don't mark
yeah.
it in any way. What I'm wondering is how much of that sort of external tradition of people either not knowing anything about clicks or not bothering with them influenced, that early writing of those kind of people influenced how natives speakers would deal with trying to deal with this stuff today.
Yeah, well, they that definitely is an important thing, right? I mean, speakers that are trying to figure this stuff out for themselves are adopting a tradition that's established by people who were not speakers of the language, you know, or who were very late in life learners, and there's a lot of influence in their first languages. But I think that, I mean, I've seen documents written as recently as like the 70s or the 80s that not only like don't, you know, they do weird things with like separating or not separating the clitics. They just don't write these things at all, right? Even the demonstrative, they just don't use them at all, which is insane because in the spoken language, it's like a fundamental part of the grammar. But yeah, as far as like the recognition of the clitic status in the older orthography, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to like separate that out from the fact that people have to also have a functionally useful writing system, and if you put everything that you possibly could into one long word, you know, you have a motivation to not do that, right? It's just basic practical stuff. So, yeah, that's a good question for sure.
The other question is about the variation in examples like this.
Yeah.
I mean, we get that sort of stuff in a bunch of different languages, and even in English, where something can be cliticized sometimes and not cliticized other times. Or if you look at Spanish, it depends on the context. So, you know, if the pronoun thing ends at this part of the word, it's a clitic. And if it ends before the word, if it ends up before the word, then it's not a clitic. So you can have stuff that can have both word status and clitic status in the language legitimately, depending either on context or on variation of choice.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know that should be a big problem. Like in our case in Neoclay, where we had very sophisticated native speakers helping us write the stuff and do the analysis, they learned very well what clitics were, but still there were cases where they would simply say, well, we would kind of like this to be an independent word, or
yeah,
you know, we'd like this one to be a clitic. And it truly was variation. You could even sort of see it in the phonology. So I don't think you necessarily have to assume that once a clitic, always a clitic.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the thing too, right, is trying to determine if there's times when they just shouldn't be considered clitics at all. I mean, like, especially, you know, the ones that are more likely to be really clearly recognized as clitics and kind of, you know, written as such in some way by speakers are those ones where, like, you have words that by themselves they wouldn't be permissible words, or there's some kind of change in the internal structure of the clitic because of phonological stuff. But something like this, the sa, doesn't actually change any of those conditions, right? It's still prosodically and distributionally, you know, functions like the other clitics. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I definitely agree that people don't need to, like, uniformly do the same thing with every particular instance. But yeah, I don't know exactly how to relate that to the kind of more abstract linguistic analysis of whether or not it's always the same thing. So yeah, but functionally, certainly people don't need to do the same thing in all cases. Yeah.
I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there. But if you could join me again, thank you, my speaker.
Yeah. Thank you.